Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. Coffee, computer open, pen. Let's see what else. Paperwork. I think I'm ready to get back here. I want to say a special thanks to Dick Whitworth and Neil Staven for sitting in the chair and doing such a fantastic job of filling in. Thank you so much for that. And the word of the day is Hast Vacation Ended. I think it's a German word. No, wait. I'm mispronouncing that. Host Vacation Ended. That's it. Sometimes I try to read too fast and I get confused. But it's nice to be back. It's nice to have a little time off. I think after 4 days off, I think I want to rename the show to Mid-Morning Late Show. Be nice to start about 9:15 or so. I'm getting a big thumbs up from Rebecca. Be kind of nice, wouldn't it?
I am totally on board.
I thought so.
Where do we sign up?
I thought so. All right. Judge Judy, $47 million a year to do her job. You get up, you tell people what to do, and you don't even have to get out of your robe. That's a good job. I was able to do some deep thinking while I was on vacation. How come the word monosyllabic has five syllables? All right. All right. We've got a great show. My first guest, Carmen LaBurge, is going to be with us, praised by both fans and press. She's always great, never less than sensational. We'll chat with her in just a minute. And then we've got a very interesting guest coming up talking about productivity. He wrote a book about it. And in my opinion, he's already won if he actually finished the book. Then you've been productive. That's cool. Adam Holtz is going to be with us as well. And then Jeff Redorn, my friend, we're going to talk about being a lukewarm Christian. That's going to be an interesting conversation. That's the day we've got planned. I'm working one day this week. Kind of nice. All right. We'll take a short break and then have Carmen join us and back in just a minute. Good morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you this morning. I am joined this morning by my very favorite guest and host of Connecting Faith, Carmen LaBurge. Good morning, Carmen.
Good morning, Bill.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm good. Great. Welcome back. You missed nothing. Nothing in the world. Nothing swirled out of control. Nobody made any bad decisions. Everyone behaved themselves while you were gone.
I like it. I like hearing that. So yesterday was the Twins home opener. And I found it fascinating. They had all the ceremony, the opening day ceremonies, one of which was they let a bald eagle loose.
Okay, I saw that.
Right. Now, I don't know what the Twins are willing to do to win this year, but the bald eagle lands on the right shoulder of the starting pitcher for Seattle, and he's a right-handed pitcher, and he tries to dig his talons into the guy's shoulder. And the pitcher was amazingly calm. I would have thrown a hysterical fit.
I feel like someone at some point in time has invited him to do some kind of visualization activity where people are throwing things at you from the stands,
right?
Because his response was strangely calm.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And to think that every time that you see one of those eagles land, it's always on some huge protective glove that the handler
right.
has. And I think to myself, what happens when it just lands on a guy's shoulder?
Do we know? I mean, did it pierce the skin?
No, it did not pierce the skin, but he said he was kind of, you know, digging his talons in trying to get a grip, which I can't imagine would be a problem for a bald eagle, but what do I know?
Well, or that synthetic material that those ball uniforms are made out of, maybe we need to share that with the military.
So I was thinking of opening day, and I get always a little nostalgic for opening days. And then I was just going back through history, and I clicked on a couple of opening days, just dating back. I went to 1948 just for fun, and I said, show me pictures of opening day in 1948. And there you see everyone in the stands, coat and tie. And I thought, huh, I mean, there was a time when you actually dressed like an adult, or you acted like with great, you were dressed in coats and ties everywhere you went, it seems.
So I have no idea where you want to go with this conversation.
That's okay.
So I'm just curious, are you wearing a suit and tie today at work?
Of course not.
Of course not.
Did cross my mind, but today is casual day, so I can wear jeans, so I actually have jeans on, which I'm very excited about.
So but, I do think that in the culture, many things have sort of lost their uniqueness. And so, I mean, when I was a kid, we got dressed up to, like, fly on an airplane.
Of course.
People do not do that anymore.
No.
And I do think that as the culture has become more casual in terms of its dress, we have become more casual in terms of our language, our treatment of one another. And this probably for a lot of people is a conversation you've had about what people wear to worship. And the Bible actually does have something to say about how it is that we should be appropriately attired in terms of entering into the presence of God. Like, we should recognize that that's one of the things that's going on there. And we always want to present ourselves as ambassadors of Jesus Christ. And that's a dignified role. In fact, it's a dignitary. And so how would a dignitary dress? Well, you and I both know they dress up, and they dress as they would if they were representing their sovereign, which is what you and I are doing every day in every context.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes this conversation, particularly if I'm having it with young women, you know, we talk about what are we saying to the world by what we're wearing? And if what I'm saying by what I'm wearing is intentionally provocative, then, you know, I'm not being a very good fisher of men in the spirit of Christ. I may be dressing like bait, but that's not what Jesus has in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that if we're constantly thinking about who we really are as the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, if we think about everything that we're doing as representing the king and the kingdom, then that probably also applies to our own personal dress code, regardless of what people around us are wearing.
I was I probably should have left more breadcrumbs on this discussion, but there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that Peggy Noonan wrote, and she was saying that she was watching old videos of the civil rights era. And she said, you see those involved, they dressed as adults with dignity. They presented themselves with self-respect. She said those that moved against segregation and racial indignity went forward in adult attire, suits, dresses, coats, ties, hats, as if adulthood were something to which to aspire. And she said, we look at some of the leaders today and we're stuck with Mark Zuckerberg's.
So, well, which probably begs the question of what is leadership and who are we looking to in terms of leadership? And so that would be an interesting conversation to have as well. I'm not sure I'm looking to Mark Zuckerberg for any form of leadership. He's not someone I am following. And so the choices that we make in terms of who we choose to follow or pattern our lives after is an important conversation. I certainly think that if you were to think about the State of the Union address and you look at how people are dressed, people in the House and in the Senate and certainly in the Supreme Court, there's a dress code. There's a very strict dress code at the Capitol. And so people need to know that. Like, there are places where there are dress codes. I remember when coaches on the sidelines used to be in coats and ties. My guess is that when people were watching the Final Four, March Madness here just recently, some people probably do wonder, why do college basketball coaches still wear coats and ties? Like, what's up with that? There's still a dress code. There's a dignity, not only to the position that they hold, but to the image they're seeking to project. And they want those young men and everybody who's watching to recognize, you know, who the coach is, and the coach is wearing what the coach is wearing for a reason. And if you and I want to be people who are whom others are going to follow and who others are going to follow into the dignity of a restored relationship with God in Jesus Christ, then we ought to be dressing the part.
Mm-hmm. And I think Peggy Noonan kind of wrapped it up where she said there is diminished incentive for people to act like adults. Everyone wants to be cool. No one wants to be pretentious. No one wants to be grim, unhip, or to be passed by in terms of style.
Well, I think that's true. And I think that what she is, one of the things that she's unmasking there or revealing is simply the devolution of culture in general. Ben Sasse's book on this subject, I think, is really important. If we want the next generation to actually ever grow out of childishness and into adulthood where they take actual responsibility, then we actually have to be equipping them for that when they are children. And so, you know, this question of whether or not the next generation of children are ever going to be adults, maybe the more serious question is, are the adults of this generation really acting like adults? And if we're not, then that's on us. You know, again, I'm a person who's more likely to send each and every one of us into the mirror than into the pointing out the flaws of others until we have seriously considered our own, in this case, attire and behavior. We do act like we're dressed. And maybe that's Peggy's point.
Yeah.
If you dress the part of a dignified ambassador of the kingdom of heaven, you're more likely to act the part. Mm-hmm. And if you dress, you know, slovenly and as if you don't care what you look like, no one else is going to care much what you have to say.
It seems that there is an increased civility when everyone's in nice clothes, whether you're, you know, that only might happen at a wedding or a funeral.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would agree with you. You know, each and every one of us, maybe the encouragement today is whatever team you're suiting up for, you know, this opening day season for baseball, you know, as you're putting on your fan attire, you know, let's be people who are dressing the part of people who are fans of Jesus Christ and people who are on his team out there in the world to win others to him.
Yeah. Well said, Carmen. All right. Let me take a little break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about a blog you wrote. Would you sell your right to vote for a 10% raise? That's up next with Carmen LeBurge. It's 17 minutes after the hour. Good morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Speaking to Carmen LeBurge from Connecting Faith and reconnectwithcarmen.com. Carmen, you recently wrote a blog about would a person be willing to sell their right to vote for a 10% raise? What did you discover?
You're impressive, man, because I posted that like 15 minutes ago.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
You can say Rebecca is the star of the show.
Hey, good morning, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Good morning. And yes, I follow Carmen's writing very closely.
Yeah.
So I read this article in Business Insider. I was totally fascinated. I had to actually then go back to the original data because I was actually so surprised by the stats. So let me tell people how this survey took place, because I do think that their methodology is probably reflected in the outcome. Have you ever, there's a lot of people listening who've probably played Would You Rather. It's a conversational game where you juxtapose two really horrible options and you make people have a forced choice between the two. And it's an opportunity to talk about, you know, morals and motivations and those kinds of things. So this survey was actually a would you rather forced choice survey. And so when we read the outcomes of the survey and we find out that more than half of those who were surveyed would be willing to sacrifice 10 more hours a week or a day a week for an extra 10% boost in their pay, we wonder to ourselves, well, what was the other thing that they were offered? Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, good point.
So I think that that's really important to know when you're reading this survey. But here's what some of the things that the survey revealed. People would actually, more than 50% of people surveyed were actually willing to give up their vote, like for the rest of their lives, for a 10% boost in their pay. 9% were willing to give up their child or future child's opportunity to ever vote. And so those were like the staggering thing. I was just like, okay, there's something more here, which is why I dug into the methodology. And I think that's always important. But it's a great conversational piece for folks who want to enter into a conversation with their neighbors or coworkers. What would you sacrifice for your vote? Like, what would you sell your vote for? Which obviously, you know, for those of us who are Christians, leads into a conversation of, you know, what would you sell your soul for? And, you know, Judas was willing to sell out Jesus for just a few pieces of silver. What am I willing to sell out Jesus for? I think those are profound, important moral questions that we can and should be having today. And sometimes there's just these kind of odd articles out there in the press that give us an opportunity to enter into really meaningful conversations with our coworkers and neighbors.
So if I do the math here, and if you 25% increase in hours for a 10% raise,
Yeah. So those were some of the things where, you know, I was thinking to myself, okay, again, there's got to be more to this.
Yeah.
Nobody was going to just say that off the, you know, would you be willing to work an extra 10 hours a week in order for a 10% raise? Well, that 10 hours a week for most people is a 25% boost in the hours they're working. Although I'll have to admit to you, I don't know a lot of people who are only working 40 hours a week now. So, you know, but people who were willing to give up a weekend day for the next year in order to get a 10% raise. That's actually a more reasonable thing to do. You know, you're talking about one additional, maybe 8-hour work day, and it's only a commitment for a year versus this other one, which was, you know, I'm willing to increase my work by 25% a week for a 10% raise, and I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. That's just, you know, whatever other option was given them was obviously significantly worse.
And Carmen, I love this line where you say God is offering to raise us 100% out of the power of sin in this life and the penalty of sin in death. Well said.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I do think that in this week after Holy Week, in this week after Easter, we do have some unique opportunities to have conversations about what does it mean, you know, not just to get a raise, but what does it mean to be people who are raised? We are people for whom Jesus was literally willing to pay it all. And it's not a question, you know, Bill, you and I know this. It's not that I give my life to him in return in some transactional way. I actually give him 100% of myself as a sacrifice of praise. The Apostle Paul talks about, you know, living our lives, giving our lives as a living sacrifice, that is actually our daily moment by moment act of worship in response to and in gratitude for all that God has done for us in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. So, Carmen, as I'm looking over some of the things going on this weekend with the Chappaquiddick movie coming out, I was thinking if Senator Kennedy would have followed the Mike Pence rule, he might today be President Kennedy.
Hmm. Well, if a lot of people had followed the Mike Pence rule, the conversations that we would be having about church leaders across the country, the conversations we would be having about our president, the conversations that we are often having in our own communities and in terms of the discipline that needs to take place in our own churches. Bill, I think if people were willing to follow the Mike Pence rule, which for those listeners who maybe haven't thought about that recently, you know, the idea is for Christians that I'm only going to spend personal one-on-one time in terms of time spent with a member of the opposite sex. That's only going to be with my husband. It's only going to be with my, you know, with my spouse. And I think that the challenge in our culture today is that we have rightly made things in the workforce in particular so equitable in relationship to men and women that we have forgotten that they still retain their all that makes them men and women. They retain all of that in the workplace. And so if you don't have personal, not only personal boundaries that you have set in advance, and a conviction and a commitment to maintain those boundaries, and a process of real accountability to those boundaries, then trust me when I tell you, a sexualized culture is going to intrude every single time on the Christian sexual ethic. It's just going to happen. It's just going to come stomping right in. And so, you know, where you and I would have a mutual commitment to the sanctity of one another's marriages, that just doesn't exist. The respect for marriage and the respect for people in married relationships does not exist in the culture at large. And so those of us who do hold marriage in honor have to fiercely defend those boundaries. And having a boundary that's set in advance that says, I'm not going to spend time alone with a member of the opposite sex without, I'm just not going to do that. Either my spouse is going to be present or there's going to be a third person. You know, there's a third person in the room. It's just, mm-hmm. So there you go. We'd be having very different conversations today.
Yeah, no doubt. Carmen, you can talk about anything and be smart on top of it. So, you know, I'm looking forward to having you in studio next week. Looking forward to meeting you in person.
Absolutely.
Can't
it's going to be fun. We'll see you then.
All right. 27 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back with lots more. It is 30 minutes after the hour. Coming up after news, Matt Perman's going to be with us. He's author of a best-selling book, What's Best Next? How the Gospel Transforms the Way You Get Things Done. He's actually a popular speaker on productivity. That, I can't wait to hear what he has to say. We'll be back in just a minute.
How long you gonna stay here, Joe?
Good morning, 35 minutes after the hour. You know, we have the ability to choose joy no matter what's going on in our lives. Pastor Rob Morgan shares more.
It sounds simplistic, but sometimes I just have to choose to be joyful, even if I don't feel that way. I remember some time ago coming back from a plane trip, and I was exhausted and coming back to a set of problems, and I was very discouraged about it and really didn't want to get off the plane. But as I read my Bible on the plane, I came across some verses about joy. And it's as though the Lord said to me, now, if you get off that plane and you go back to work and you just decide you're going to be joyful, then everything's going to work out all right. But if you slink off that plane and you're down in the mouth and down in the dumps and discouraged, then things are going to get worse. And I decided I was going to get off that plane and go get in my car, and I was going to smile and have joy in my heart, whether I felt like it or not. And I just made a choice to have joy by faith, because after all, it says rejoice in the Lord, and that's a commandment. And the thing you have to do with commandments is to choose to obey them. And you know that when I choose to be joyful and I just say, well, this is the day the Lord has made, I will rejoice, that somehow the emotions catch up with that decision.
If you want to hear that full interview, head over to MyFaithRadio.com, type in Rob Morgan, and it'll get you to that interview. All right. Do you feel stuck? What about that? How to be unstuck is we're going to talk about next with my guest, Matt Perman. Be back in just a minute.
Frequently we hear all politicians are liars or throw the bums out, all of them. I strongly disagree. This is Jim Garlow. Politics is not a dirty word. It's a calling to be highly respected. Then why such a negative view? Could it be because government is failing to be what a government is supposed to be? The primary purpose of government is to protect its citizens, to do so by restraining evil. Isaiah said it centuries ago, "For the Lord is our judge, our lawgiver, our king. It is he who will save us." So are we advocating a theocracy where religious rulers govern based on what God has spoken? No. To affirm God's role in government is not to call for some type of a theocracy. Our goal is for our government to protect our God-given rights. Stay well-versed in these issues at jimgarlow.com. Be prepared to live out your faith.
Good morning, the big hands on the 37. Happy Friday. I have on our studio line Matt Perman. He's the author of the best-selling book, What's Best Next? How the Gospel Transforms the Way We Get Things Done. And his new book is called How to Get Unstuck, Breaking Free from Barriers to Your Productivity. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Congratulations on both books. The fact that you were productive enough to get the book done, way to go.
Oh, thanks. It was hard, and I actually got stuck writing the book.
Well, I want to talk about that. You know, for most men, their response is, I'll get it done. You don't have to remind me every 6 months.
Yeah.
What is with our problem of being stuck? Why is that so natural?
Well, especially these days, a big reason it happens is because of busyness. We have so many things coming our way. much more than we can handle, information overload, text messages, email, all that stuff. So now more than ever, it's more important to be able to distinguish what's important from what's merely urgent.
So distractions are a big problem.
Huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you have come up with 8 core principles at the heart of really becoming a more effective person for the glory of God. So I would love to jump into some of these.
Yeah, definitely.
Where do we begin?
Well, the first principle I start with is this distinction between urgency and importance. And a lot of people have heard about that, but only at a superficial level. When I started looking into it at a deeper level, I was just amazed. And the big thing I found is, you know, a lot of us, we end up doing what's urgent but not what's important. The question is why? And what I discovered is that urgent things press upon us. It's like the buzz of a text message, a call on your phone, a crying baby. All those things press upon you, whereas important things don't typically press upon you. Creating a long-term plan for your marketing department, preparing for the meeting next month on strategy, those things, they always feel like they're postponable. They don't press upon you. And so it's harder to do them because it requires us to take the initiative. And it can at first feel less satisfying. It's satisfying to do urgent things. We feel like we're needed. We just accomplished something. Important things, since they don't press upon us, it's harder to take that initiative and do it. And Stephen Covey puts it so well, the noise of urgency creates the illusion of importance. So a lot of times we get deluded into thinking that because something is urgent, it must be important. But that's not necessarily so.
Well, we love paying attention to people that pay attention to what's important. For example,
yeah,
we love to go watch Max Scherzer pitch because he has spent his whole life paying attention to what's important, which is his pitching. Therefore, we're real happy to go spend our money to go watch him pitch. Or fill in the blank of any musician or any performer. It's like they have paid attention to the important.
Yeah, and they become great at what they're doing. And if they didn't put in the practice time or it was low-quality practice because they were texting the whole time they were practicing, they wouldn't have achieved that level of greatness.
All right.
So
okay, now, Matt, that brings me up to the next point of the importance of personal discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a nice tie-in. Say more about that.
Yeah, discipline is really important. Discipline, it comes down to sticking with what you're doing, staying focused. Now, we all know we need to have discipline. The question is, how do you have discipline? And there is a way to build discipline, and I've got a short chapter on this towards the end of the book. And the way you build discipline is starting small, make commitments with yourself and keep them. And as you do that, your discipline muscle will grow and you'll be able to make and keep bigger commitments. So, and it's helpful just to start out in one area and it won't have spillover effects. So let's say it's exercise. If you want to get disciplined, you start maybe by running, and instead of overloading yourself and trying to run 6 days a week for 5 miles right out of the gate, which you're probably not going to be able to do, start with 1 mile 3 times the first week, go up to 2 miles, 3 miles, build slowly, and that builds your muscle of discipline so you can take on bigger tasks. So then you can apply that to other areas of your productivity, getting up in the morning, doing email, staying committed on important tasks for a whole hour, things like that.
Matt, why do we play so many games with ourselves? Like if we say, okay, Saturday morning, I need to clean that closet in the basement. So you get up and today's the day I'm going to do it. But you know what I really should do first? Just grab a bran muffin and a coffee. So I'll shoot up to the coffee shop and get that. That's a good way to get the day started. And then all of a sudden it's 5 o'clock and you haven't even gone near the basement yet. Why do we do that with why do we play games?
Oh, yeah. And we just do that all the time. One reason is because the task is unpleasant.
Okay.
And so we put it off because it's not going to be very enjoyable to us. Sometimes the task is difficult, arduous, challenging, and it's just easy to find substitutes, other things to do instead. It's another version of going with the urgent over important. In this case, the so-called urgent is what we feel like doing.
Well, what about making lists? Is that a good idea, or are lists something that just are designed to overwhelm you and go, well, I can't get everything done on my list. What's the point?
Well, it is a good idea, but there are many pitfalls to it, and I've fallen into them. At one point, I just had so many lists, and there would be hundreds of things on them, and it was just overwhelming. It was way too much to do. And then I wouldn't want to add something to my list because it would just get lost because there's so much on there. So lists can be overdone. It can be hard to figure out how to organize them. But what I found is you still need to make them. If you make a list of next actions for about the next week, things you have to do over the next week, and you organize that by area of life or area of your job, then I found it works very effectively. But you got to keep it limited to about the next week. If there's something you're not going to do for 2 or 3 weeks and you have it on your list, it's just going to get in the way because you're going to want to skip over it every time, and you'll have so many things, the list will be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Does productivity beget productivity?
Well, yeah, because as we create momentum, we keep going, and we go faster, we get in the zone, we have higher quality work, and other people will want to give us more things to do because they see we are excelling. But what can happen is you can get so much coming at you that you end up sinking. David Allen puts it well. He says the better you get, the better you better get, because as you get better at productivity, there will be more things coming your way, and eventually you will reach a crashing point if you don't keep getting better or learn how to say no.
Mm-hmm. Matt, are there starter tasks that can trigger bigger tasks?
For example, I get up
in the morning, and if I really want to have a productive day, I'll do my laundry. I'll wash, dry, everything's folded and put away, and now I feel like I can take on the world.
Yeah. That's something that can really help. Sometimes doing the tasks that are going to energize you builds your level of energy, so then you're able to do the more difficult, challenging tasks. And if getting your laundry out of the way is one of those things, then that's great. This is also a way to help conquer procrastination. If you have a very large project coming up, you know, a lot of times if you just think work on XYZ project, you're going to feel overwhelmed by it. But if you break it down into some steps and identify maybe a 10-minute task on the project you could do, that's not going to feel so overwhelming. You're much more likely to do it. As you get into it, you might find you like it, you get momentum, and you want to keep going, and maybe you end up working on the project for 1 or 2 hours. So identifying a small task like that to do can be a very effective solution to procrastination.
Matt, let me take a break. When I come back, I want to ask you about the fear of completing a task. And I'll talk about that more when we return. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Matt Perman's my guest. I'll be right back. It's 11 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Matt Perman, who's a productivity expert. During the break, he shaved, ran the dog, and made polenta. So this guy really knows what he's doing. So, Matt, let me ask you this. When it comes to, what about the fear of completing a task? So if I finish writing a book, then I'm done writing it. Then I can't talk about it anymore. Then I'm going to be judged as to whether or not the book's any good.
Yeah. Ironically, we can sabotage ourselves out of fear of success, fear of getting something done, and it's going to lead to other things. We might not feel prepared, or we might fear we're going to be judged negatively. So that does happen, and we need to be aware of it. It's an example of one of the internal obstacles we can have to our productivity that gets us stuck. And that goes back to things like our self-talk. What messages are we giving ourselves? And I got a chapter in the book on preaching to yourself, where I say, hey, instead of just listening to ourselves, we need to be proactive and preach to ourselves what's true and a more positive message. Sometimes our self-talk is negative. Oh, things are going to go bad if I finish this or do this. And we need to realize that's not usually grounded in reality, and preach to ourselves what the truth is. And that will help with internal obstacles like that.
Matt, do you think sometimes people just feel comfortable with the idea that they have a project in the offing that they kind of know in their heart that they may never get done, but at least it gives them something to talk about, and that way they've got something in conversation. Yeah, I'm working on this new book, and how's that going? Well, I don't know. I've been working on it for 9 years.
Well, we do hear about that a lot, and I think one of the biggest obstacles people have when there's a project they just keep having in the offing and they're not really making much progress is maybe they're not sure how to do it. Maybe there's obstacles like that. I found that on my first book. It was hard to write because it was hard to figure out how to write a book. I saw that it is actually very different from writing articles and blog posts. So I had a new skill to learn, and that made it harder. It created resistance. I had to get past resistance to work on the book each day. When I would do it, it wouldn't be very good at first because I didn't know what I was doing. I had things to learn. I didn't know where to learn those things. Things like, how do you start a chapter well? How do you organize it? There were a lot of tasks I hadn't anticipated, and that's what happens to us a lot of times. And that's why projects will just stick around sometimes. And a solution to that can be to talk to experts who really know what they're doing, have done that task before, so you can help identify some of those hidden precedent tasks.
All right, Matt, here's the 3-2 pitch. How do you know when you're being effective versus just being busy?
Yeah, well, we got to make that distinction between effectiveness and efficiency. Effectiveness is getting the right things done. So it's not just getting anything done. You can get a lot done in a day, but not be effective.
Right.
You're just busy.
I know all about that.
Oh, yeah. So do I. Effective things are things that tie to goals and a larger vision for your work and for your life. So that's how you know if something is the right thing. Is it in line with certain goals? And those goals, of course, they need to be set on the basis of correct principles, because we can set the wrong goals too. You don't want to spend all this time climbing a ladder and find it's against the wrong wall. So goals and vision have to be based in principles, things like what do I have most best to offer to the world? What's needed out there by people? Things like that help us identify if our goals are truly meaningful.
So, Matt, in discussion with people, and you talk to people about your book and about their productivity, how many people would admit that they don't have goals? I mean, we're starting with the premise that people have goals.
That's a great question. It's few people who will say they don't have goals. I think the big thing is most people have goals, but most people haven't written them down. And studies show that's the big difference. If you write your goals down, then you are significantly more likely to complete them than if you just have them in your head. So most of us have goals, but we don't take that crucial step of writing them down.
Now, when you write the goals down, do you then show them to somebody that you can trust, or do you just keep them in your little private blog journal?
Well, yeah, it can be helpful to show them to others. Then you bring in a measure of accountability, and to some degree, because you've shared your goals now with others, you will be more committed to them because you want to deliver on them. So that can be very helpful, but just kind of be aware of the motives. If your motive is just to share the goals because you want to make yourself look good because you have these goals, that's probably not going to help you get them done. Or if you do, it's not the best motivation behind getting them done. So, yeah, have a few people you share your goals with. That's helpful, but don't do it because you are boasting.
Okay, so let's talk about, just in our time left, about a minute, the true effectiveness would be doing something God's way and for God's glory. So how do we get started pursuing that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it comes from knowing the scriptures well, so we know what types of things God wants, and then our motives, true things that are, God cares about the motives. And for something to be productive before him, it needs to be done out of love for him and love for others. And love is goodwill for the other person, wanting what's best for them. So we need to let that guide us and motivate us in all of our productivity.
Matt, I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for writing the book and coming on the show. And I want to get back into your book and study some of the 8 principles you have for personal effectiveness. I think we can all benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You
the
bet.
Website for the book is howtogetunstuckbook.com.
Howtogetunstuckbook.com. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Awesome.
That's
Thanks,
right.
Matt. Have a great day.
Thank you.
You bet. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up hour one. Thanks to Matt Furman and also to Carmen LaBurge for hour one. What a great first hour. It's nice to be back in the studio with Rebecca Maxwell and Paul Perreault and the big morning show. Awfully nice to have a couple days off, but great to be back. We've got a great second hour coming up. Adam Holtz is going to be with us. We're going to be talking movies with Adam, and then my friend and Bible scholar and mentor, Jeff Verdorn, is going to be coming into the studio. We're going to be talking about lukewarm Christianity. Uh-oh, I'm already nervous. It's going to be a great second hour coming up. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.